Previously, I had discussed three 19th century German philosophers, Hegel, Dilthey, and Nietzsche. Today, I would like to make the switch to the 20th century, the early 20th century, or rather the turning point, that moment of transition between end of the 19th and the early 20th century. It's a very important time. On the threshold of the 20th century, Europe was at the top of its power, and never before had the political and military and economic domination of the Europeans spread so far across to other continents. Now, in the following decades, as a result of the destructive and bloody First World War, part of that European power imploded. And then during the interwar period, and especially right after the Second World War, the European world domination would increasingly diminish, with more and more countries throwing off the colonial yoke. That's a topic actually for next year's course. So you can say that the year 1900 was in many respects a breaking point, and that was also true for commonly held views on art. Until well into the 19th century, it was possible to identify a dominant taste in the arts. In architecture, for instance, you can say that that was neoclassicism. In painting, you could say that it was the academic style, namely the style of painting rather realistic as it was being taught at the academies, such as the Academy of Antwerp. If you walk through the academy, through the main building, you see all of these plaster casts of classical sculptures. Well, they were originally made in the 19th century in order to serve as inspiration for young painters and sculptors. So certainly many artists had raised objections against that dominant taste in architecture or in literature or in painting. From Romanticism onwards, writers, artists, and art lovers laid claim to a sense of taste that was expressly different from what was commonly accepted. Think of the theater plays of the Sturm und Drang, which I talked about, the German Romantic theater, or think of, in architecture, you can think of the Villa of Strawberry Hill, built by Horace Walpole, which was in a Gothic slash Oriental style. From the standpoint of today, such voices carry great weight because they were the harbinger of something new. But in their own time, they often merely expressed a dissenting opinion, which could not in itself shake up the whole culture. So what we have now is, for the most part of the 19th century, a dominant taste that has been inherited from tradition, and it is still quite vigorous. Now, by the end of the 19th century, there was no longer one dominant taste. The counter-reactions had become stronger, and that had resulted in what is known as Victorian culture. It's named after Queen Victoria of the United Kingdom, one of the most important rulers of her time, and she's also special because she ruled for such a large period of time, almost the entire second half of the 19th century, she was in power. Victorianism, as it is called, manifests itself in an unprecedented eclecticism. In art and decoration, you had one revival style after the other, and wealthy citizens who bought art and who bought decorative objects apparently had no qualms about the fact that their living rooms looked like art historical battlefields, where Gothic revival, neo-Rococo, and Orientalism cheerfully coexisted. Victorian eclecticism must be understood against the background of the historical obsession of the 19th century. Last week and the week before, I discussed some of the symptoms of that historical obsession, such as extensive restoration campaigns and the first large archaeological excavations. The result was that young and critical voices increasingly felt that European culture was stuck in its own past. One of the thinkers who experienced a growing dissatisfaction with the historical disease, as he called it, has already made an appearance in the previous episode of this podcast. 2 years after the birth of tragedy, Friedrich Nietzsche, German philosopher, published a second book in his series of cultural criticism. And that series is called The Untimely Meditations, or Unzeitgemäße Betrachtungen, because Nietzsche felt that what he was saying was not really in touch, was not really connecting to what his his contemporaries were doing and thinking. And the evocative title of that pamphlet, that second book that he writes, is On the Uses and Disadvantages of History for Life, Vom Nutzen und Nachteil der Historie für das Leben. And so that's already a very evident sign that Nietzsche is quite critical towards the historical obsession of his contemporaries. Nietzsche accurately diagnoses his fellow human beings of the Victorian age. The hypertrophic growth of knowledge has turned them into what he calls walking encyclopedias. They're constantly feeding themselves with exotic and distinct cultures, philosophy, and religions. As a result, they no longer have any personal taste. They are merely a container of foreign cultures or ancient cultures, which they use to satisfy their curiosity, but not to produce something original themselves. Nietzsche asks it as follows, and I quote, "Are there still human beings?" one then asks oneself, "or perhaps only thinking, writing, and speaking machines?" End of quote. The younger generation, according to Nietzsche, the generation of his own time, is therefore a race of inborn gray-hairedness. That's what he calls them. That's how he calls them. Even worse, in their ironic self-awareness, they accept being mere epigones of bygone periods. In Hegel's philosophy of history, Nietzsche sees the culmination of this ironic self-awareness. The Hegelian is in reality a cynic, whose knowledge of history leads him to acquiesce in everything that happens. He is the living example of how the knowledge of history can actually harm life. Nietzsche defends the position of the man of action as opposed to that of the philosopher who places himself above history. And I will give you another quote from that same book by Nietzsche. "We need history, certainly, but we need it for reasons different from those for which the idler in the garden of knowledge needs it, even though he may look nobly down on our rough and charmless needs and requirements. We need it, that is to say, for the sake of life and action, not so as to turn comfortably away from life and action, let alone for the purpose of extenuating the self-seeking life and the base and cowardly action. We want to serve history only to the extent that history serves life, for it is possible to value the study of history to such degree that life becomes stunted and degenerate." End of quote. According to Nietzsche, that was exactly what was happening in his own time. The study of history had become so important that life itself became stunted and degenerate. The Victorian people, according to Nietzsche, were stuck in their love of history, their infatuation with history. So, okay, that's what Nietzsche wrote in 1874. And his tirade against historic man must have been music to the ears of his much younger contemporary, Filippo Tommaso Marinetti. Marinetti is an Italian poet and journalist. Around the turn of the century, he was working as a journalist and as a literary critic in Paris and in northern Italy. He witnessed the Italo-Turkish War and the First Balkan War as a reporter, and his dissatisfaction, exactly like Nietzsche, he was dissatisfied with the culture of his own time, led him to write the Manifesto of Futurism, which he managed to publish on the front page of the leading French newspaper Le Figaro in 1909. It was a bomb. It was a bombshell. It exploded like a bomb in the Parisian art world. And that was no coincidence, since Marinetti was very well aware that Paris was considered the artistic capital of Europe. So he knew if he wanted to make some noise, if he wanted to shake up the art world, he would better publish it in French and publish it in France, in Paris, to be precise. The publication of the Futurist Manifesto is the starting date of the so-called historical avant-garde. That is the collective term that we use for the many innovative artists' collectives that emerged at the beginning of the 20th century. It is regularly accepted to include the Dadaists in Switzerland, Germany and the Low Countries and France, the Futurists in Italy, the Futurists in Russia, the Surrealists in France, the Constructivists in Russia, the followers of De Stael in the Netherlands, and so on. the artists who were members of the diverse avant-garde movements cannot be captured under a single common label. Their intention was precisely not to create a new artistic style, because that would be simply nothing more than a new product for the ever-hungry art market. On the contrary, avant-garde artists were concerned about the use of art in everyday life. That explains their numerous alliances with the social field, most conspicuously with the field of politics, but also with other domains of life, such as the culinary domain. Marinetti, for instance, helped to found a futuristic restaurant in Turin, the Taverna Santo Palato, which served experimental dishes, such as fried red roses or milk under a green light. These were some of the dishes that you could have at the Santo Palato. Now, the German literary historian Peter Bürger has aptly described the avant-garde program as, and I quote, "the attempt to organize a new life praxis from a basis in art," end of quote. If you want to understand the avant-garde correctly, this is a very important quote: "the attempt to organize a new life praxis from a basis in art." If you want to know why the surrealists were so willing to ally themselves with the French Communist Party, if you want to know why there are so many references to politics in Dadaist art, if you want to know why the constructivists in Russia were so hungry and so eager to collaborate with the Bolshevik movement, this is it. This is it. Avant-garde artists were fed up with art having nothing to say about society. They were fed up with the distanced attitude of many artists, and distanced and therefore also alienated attitude of many artists. Now, before I turn to futurism as one example of the historical avant-garde, I should say a few things about the relation between futurism and Italian fascism. And here is the point where it really fits in quite well. As I said, many avant-garde movements had a relation to political parties, but in most cases, this was with socialist or communist parties. In the case of futurism, Marinetti was an avid supporter. Marinetti, the frontman, the leader of futurism in Italy, he was an avid supporter of Benito Mussolini, the fascist leader. Marinetti even was the co-author of the Fascist Manifesto in 1919, and he would continue to endorse fascism until his death, just before the end of the Second World War in 1944. I should add that there were also other dissenting futurists who left the movement when the relations with fascism became closer. And that relation with fascism was not a very great success. A few years after the First World War, Marinetti was quite disappointed by Mussolini's refusal to elevate futurism to the official art movement of the New Italy. It's actually quite ambiguous. If you look at the aesthetics of the fascist movement in Italy, there is indeed, in the beginning, a decided preference for a modern aesthetic. A very good example is the Casa del Fascio, the building formerly known as the Casa del Fascio in Como, a city in the north of Italy, in Lombardy. It's also called the Palazzo Terragni. It's a building designed by the Italian rationalist architect Giuseppe Terragni and was completed in 1936 under the regime of Benito Mussolini as the seat of the local branch of the National Fascist Party. However, this modernist aesthetic of the Italian fascists, which Marinetti, of course, very much liked, quickly disappeared, and in its place came a pompous neoclassicist aesthetic, not unlike what you found in the buildings built under the Nazi regime in Germany. Obviously, Marinetti was disappointed, but nevertheless, during the 1930s and also during the Second World War, he continued to connect with the fascist regime. He even took positions that contradicted his earlier choices. For example, he became a member of the new Accademia d'Italia, the Italian Academy that Mussolini had created, while previously Marinetti had loudly shouted out his aversion, his hostility to any kind of academy. So figure of Marinetti is certainly paradoxical, ambiguous, and it continues to stir up controversies, which I recently experienced myself. I edited and published a new Dutch translation of the Futurist Manifestos. It just came out a few weeks ago. And some people ask themselves on social media, why are you doing this? Why would you publish a fascist? So I think there's enough in the texts of Marinetti that supersedes his fascism. I will not try to put it under the curtain or something, shove it under the carpet. I mean, if that's an expression in English, at least. I will not try to hide it, that Marinetti was a fascist, but I think there is other elements in his work as well, which you cannot... which remain fascinating up until today. And so let's have a look at that actual message and that history of the Italian Futurist movement. So chronologically, Italian Futurism was the first of these avant-garde movements in Europe. Futurism introduced itself as the opposite of what it called passéism, or the uncritical worship of the past. The group's strategy was provocation. They organized evening programs, or serate, in major Italian opera houses and theaters, where they recited futurist poems and manifestos, played futurist musical instruments or noise instruments, and presented futurist paintings. The cost of tickets in the upper galleries of the theaters was deliberately kept as low as possible on these occasions, so as to fill the theater to the brim with a broad cross-section of the Italian population, so that it could reach as many people as possible and that they could shock as many people as possible. Their strategy was that of provocation. Just like in the manifestos, you also find this strategy. They paid homage to technology, to industrialization, to violence, to war, and to what they called the contempt of woman. I should say something about this because not only Marinetti is frequently reduced to his fascist convictions, but also he's frequently called an anti-feminist. And again, indeed, there are passages in his work where he rails against, or he proclaims that he is an anti-feminist. Now, it's good to understand this in its own time because actually, Marinetti is not against emancipated women. On the contrary, he is in favor of emancipated women. What he actually is against is feminism in the sense of the adoration of women, as it was widespread during the fin de siècle in the late 19th century. You had this stereotypical and very passive image of woman. And that's what he's actually acting against, because in practice, the Futurist movement had a lot of participating female artists as well, amongst which Marinetti's own wife. So the contempt of woman is something that we have to qualify. We cannot take it at its face value. If you want a visual example of this strategy of provocation, you can have a look at one of the book cover designs by the Futurist artist Ivo Panaggi. It's a design for a book called L'Antiteatro, meaning the anti-theater, and the cover shows an image of a classical amphitheater being pierced by a gigantic red arrow. This is how Futurism saw the modern age and modern art and itself as a gigantic arrow pointing towards the future, piercing and destroying the old world. By the way, it's no coincidence that the book, which was not written by Panaggi, he only illustrated it, deals with a typically modern art form, namely film. And this was indeed seen by the Futurists as a potential kind of anti-theater, anti-traditional theater. Good. Another typical example of their strategies was their intervention in the touristic center of Venice in April 1910. On a beautiful Sunday afternoon, three futurists climbed the early Renaissance clock tower in St. Mark's Square. While Marinetti started to read the first Futurist manifesto to the Venetians through a megaphone, his accomplices distributed thousands of printed copies over the heads of surprised tourists and Sunday strollers. For the futurists, Venice symbolized the unbridled adoration of the past. It was the cloaca massima of Passyism, the sewer of Passyism, as they said. The futurists, on the other hand, proposed industrialization, militarization, and the installation of electricity in Venice. Let me quote the first part of this manifesto in full, because it will give you a feel of how the futurists addressed their contemporaries. It will also give you a feel of their ideas and what they believed. So, this is what Marinetti said through his megaphone to the people of Venice. "We repudiate the old Venice, enfeebled and undone by centuries of worldly pleasure, though we too once loved and possessed it in a great nostalgic dream. We repudiate the Venice of foreigners, a market for counterfeiting antiquarians, a magnet of snobbery and universal imbecility. We want to cure and heal this putrefying city, this magnificent sore from the past. We want to reanimate and ennoble the Venetian people, who have fallen from their ancient grandeur, drugged by the morphine of nauseating cowardice and debased by the habit of shady business. We want to prepare the birth of an industrial and military Venice that can dominate the Adriatic Sea, that great Italian lake. Let us hasten to fill in its little reeking canals with the ruins from its leprous and crumbling palaces. Let us burn the gondolas, those rocking chairs for Cretans, and raise to the heavens the imposing geometry of metal bridges and factories plumed with smoke, to abolish the cascading curves of the old architecture." End of quote. So the appearance of the futurists demonstrates that the transition from the 19th to the 20th century is actually a rupture. For the first time, this awareness of history has become so strong that the past is seen as a threat to the present. And this is really a turning point, because previously, almost every artist, almost every art theorist, every philosopher who had looked at art was convinced, or implicitly assumed, that the past always served as an inspiration to the present, and that new artists, young artists, built further upon what their forefathers, their ancestors had achieved. And you were developing the same line, you could say, the same art historical movement. With the futurists, this is explicitly turned around. New art can only succeed if it breaks with old art. Philosophically, futurism is so important because it advocates an aesthetic of rupture. According to the Futurist Manifesto, museums are cemeteries and they may be submerged. Libraries can be burned. Other avant-garde artists shared these feelings. For instance, the French poet Antonin Artaud argued that there is no more need for masterpieces. Important are not the dead, petrified products of artistic forces of the past, but the live action of the same forces today. Let me quote from one of his manifestos. By the way, this is not a futurist manifesto, this is actually a surrealist manifesto, but the sentiment, the basic attitude towards the past is the same. I quote, "Let them burn down the library at Alexandria. There are powers above and beyond papyri. We may be temporarily deprived of the ability to rediscover these powers, but we will never eliminate their energy." End of quote. So what you get here is the belief in a clean slate, in a tabula rasa, and doing away with everything that exists and starting afresh. It's a kind of aesthetic terrorism, and I'm not shunning away from this word. It's a kind of aesthetic terrorism because we see that there is, of course, a worrying parallel to what has recently happened when terrorists have destroyed monuments in Palmyra, for instance, in Syria, or in Afghanistan with the Buddhas that were destroyed by the Taliban. So there is a destructive energy here in avant-garde art, which is, I think, still present in modern art and contemporary art. You can see this sometimes in one of the scandals that erupts around contemporary art. And I think it's still related to the same destructive energy, the same belief that the new can only originate by severing its ties with the old. Tradition has always been something very problematic for contemporary artists. Now, you can charge the futurists with a destructive approach, but not with inconsistency. Futurism actually, and that therefore they are to be admired, I believe, they are the only art movement that explicitly included its own destruction in its program. Let me give you a quote illustrating this from the first Futurist Manifesto. "The oldest of us is 30, so we have at least a decade left to fulfill our task. When we are 40, others who are younger and stronger will throw us into the wastebasket like useless manuscripts. We want it to happen." End of quote. This new aesthetic, which preferred beauty of cars and machine guns above ancient Greek statues, was a slap in the face of the European art-loving public when it appeared on the front page of Le Figaro on February 1909. The introduction to the manifesto, and I'm going to read you the beginning of the manifesto, the introduction is a lyrical text telling of Marinetti's love for his sports car, which he calls a snorting beast. He tells how he rips through the streets at an insane speed, barely manages to avoid a collision with two cyclists, cyclists are another symbol of modernity, and so crashes his car in a ditch near a factory. And that is the starting point, his car crash, for his praise of the new artistic forces. Danger, speed, recklessness, and violence. These are the forces that the artist of today should venerate. Okay, let me put on my futurist voice and give you the main tenets of futurism in a few quotes. I quote, "And so, our faces covered with the good factory slime, a mix of metallic scum, useless sweat, heavenly soot, our arms bruised and bandaged, we, still fearless, have dictated our first intentions to all the living men of the earth." The Manifesto of Futurism. 1. We intend to sing to the love of danger, the habit of energy and fearlessness. 2. Courage, boldness and rebelliousness will be the essential elements of our poetry. 3. Up to now, literature has exalted contemplative stillness, ecstasy and sleep. We intend to exalt movement and aggression, feverish insomnia, the racer's stride, the mortal leap, the slap and the punch. 4. We affirm that the beauty of the world has been enriched with a new form of beauty, the beauty of speed. A racing car with a hood that glistens with large pipes, resembling a serpent with explosive breath. A roaring automobile that seems to ride on grapeshot. That is more beautiful than the victory of Samothrace. We intend to hymn man at the steering wheel, the ideal axis of which intersects the earth, itself hurled ahead in its own race along the path of its orbit. 6. Henceforth, poets must do their utmost with ardor, splendor, and generosity to increase the enthusiastic fervor of the primordial elements. 7. There is no beauty that does not consist of struggle. No work that lacks an aggressive character can be considered a masterpiece. Poetry must be conceived as a violent assault launched against unknown forces to reduce them to submission under man. 8. We stand on the last promontory of the centuries. Why should we look back over our shoulders when we intend to breach the mysterious doors of the impossible? Time and space have died yesterday. We already live in the absolute, for we have already created velocity, which is eternal and omnipresent. 9. We intend to glorify war, the only hygiene of the world. Militarism, patriotism, the destructive gesture of anarchists, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and contempt for women. 10. We intend to destroy museums, libraries, academies of every sort, and to fight against moralism, feminism, and every utilitarian or opportunistic cowardice. 11. We shall sing the great masses, shaken with work, pleasure or rebellion. We shall sing the multicolored and polyphonic tidal waves of revolution in the modern metropolis, shall sing the vibrating nocturnal fervor of factories and shipyards burning under violent electrical moons, bloated railroad stations that devour smoking serpents, factories hanging from the sky by the twisting threads of spiraling smoke, bridges like gigantic gymnasts who span rivers, flashing at the sun with the gleam of a knife, adventurous steamships that scent the horizon, locomotives with their swollen chest, pawing the tracks like massive steel horses bridled with pipes, and the oscillating flight of airplanes whose propeller flaps at the wind like a flag and seems to applaud like a delirious crowd. It is from Italy that we are flinging this to the world, our manifesto of burning and overwhelming violence with which we today establish futurism. For we intend to free this nation from its fetid cancer of professors, archaeologists, tour guides, and antiquarians. For much too long, Italy has been a flea market. We intend to liberate it from the countless museums that have covered it like so many cemeteries. Museums, cemeteries, identical, really, in the horrible promiscuity of so many bodies scarcely known to one another. Museums, public dormitories in which someone is put to sleep forever alongside others he hated or didn't know. That once a year you might make a pilgrimage, such as one makes an annual visit to a graveyard. I'll grant you that. That once a year you can deposit a wreath of flowers in front of the Mona Lisa. I permit you that. But I cannot countenance the idea that our sorrows are daily shepherded on a tour through museums, or our weak courage, our pathological restlessness. Why would we wish to poison ourselves? Why wish to rot? And what is there to see in an old painting beside the laborious distortion of the artist who tried to break through the insuperable barriers which blocked his desire to express fully his dream? To admire an old painting is the same as pouring our sensibility into a funerary urn instead of casting it forward into the distance in violent spurts of creation and action. Do you wish to waste your best strength in this eternal and useless admiration of the past, an activity that will only leave you fatally spent, diminished, crushed? I declare, in all truth, that a daily visit to museums, libraries and academies, cemeteries of futile efforts, calvaries of crucified dreams, record books of broken assaults, is as dangerous for artists as a prolonged guardianship under the thumb of one's family is for certain young talents, intoxicated with their own genius and their ambitious aims. For the sickly, the ill or the imprisoned, let them go and visit. The admirable past is perhaps solace for their troubles, since the future is now closed for them. But we intend to know nothing of it, nothing of the past, we, strong and youthful futurists. And so let the glad arsonists with charred fingers come. Here they are, here they are. Go ahead, set fire to the shelves of the libraries, turn aside the course of the canals to flood the museums. Oh, the joy of seeing all the glorious old canvases floating adrift on the waters, shredded and discolored. Seize your pickaxes, axes and hammers, and tear down, pitilessly tear down, the venerable cities. The oldest of us is 30, so we have at least a decade left to fulfill our task. When we are 40, others who are younger and stronger will throw us into the wastebasket like useless manuscripts. We want that to happen. They will come against us, our successors. They will come from far away, from every direction, dancing to the winged cadence of their first songs, extending predatory claws, sniffing dog-like at doors of the academies for the good smell of our decaying minds, long since promised to the library's catacombs. But we won't be there. They will find us at last one wintry night in an open field beneath a sad roof drummed by monotonous rain, crouched beside our trembling airplanes, and in the act of warming our hands by the dirty little fire made by the books we are writing today, flaming beneath the flight of our imaginings. Panting with contempt and anxiety, they will storm around us, and all of them, exasperated by our lofty daring, will attempt to kill us, driven by a hatred all the more implacable because their hearts will be intoxicated with love and admiration for us. In their eyes, strong and healthy injustice will radiantly burst. Art, in fact, can be nothing if not violence, cruelty, and injustice. The oldest of us is 30, and yet already we have cast away treasures, thousands of treasures of force, love, boldness, cunning, and raw willpower, have thrown them away impatiently, furiously, heedlessly, without hesitation, without rest, screaming for our lives. Look at us! We are still not weary. Our hearts feel no tiredness because they are fed with fire, hatred, and speed. Are you astounded? Of course you are, because you can't even recall having ever been alive. Standing erect on the summit of the world, yet once more we fling our challenge to the stars. End of quote. I hope you have enjoyed this podcast, and I hope to see you again next week.